Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Cinema D'Amore. I'm your host, Chuck Phillips, joined by
Justin Morgan.
And we're, you know, we're a little slow to get to Halloween this year. We usually go all out. Last year we did seven films, I think. And this year we had to sacrifice quality for quantity somewhat. And just work two films in, but I mean, total, we're getting like 8 stories. So, I mean, you know, we're really packing them in. We're getting just as much value out of these two films as we did last year with 7 films. And this week, we're starting off with, one of the originals, which is kind of why I wanted to, I always like to start where it began. We did Giallo month, and then my first thought was doing The Girl Who Knew Too Much, as that's considered the original Giallo film. It might not be the best. It's probably not even my favorite. I think there's others that clearly surpassed it. But I don't know. Something about going back and seeing where it all starts.
The Girl Who Knew Too Much or this one?
Either one of them. Although this movie is really good. I do really enjoy it. But I think there are other movies that maybe surpass it in some ways. This definitely, being from the 40s, their conception of horror is not always the most frightening thing in the world compared to some of the stuff that came out in like the 70s and 80s with some other stuff.
I had a similar thought when I was watching it.
I mean, there's a few things that...
It was a little too British sometimes.
Especially... We'll get into that. I know exactly which one you're probably thinking is the most British thing you've ever seen and heard in your life, which would be the fourth story. But... something about this is very interesting in that most of the time I've seen a lot of these anthology films. I've seen all of the Amicus anthology films, which I think they're all great, but they don't, almost none of them have a good frame story. It's just like an excuse to do 5 short films, and then it's very lightly strung together by like some sinister character being like, oh, but don't you know you're all dead or something like that? Like that's half of the Amicus films. It ends with them being like, oh, didn't you know you're all already dead or something like that? Or you're about to die. I think that's the plot to one of them, is they're all on a train that's about to crash. And, the guy tells their stories.
I kind of thought that was happening in the very first story in this one. I thought that's where they were going. He was going to be dead the whole time.
Yeah. There's a, we'll get into the stories. These are
how about
all
the premise.
Well, the premise, it is an interesting
idea. It does have one.
It does. Exactly. It does have a good frame story. An architect is called to the British countryside to visit a guy's house. And like right off the bat, everything seems weird. He has this, that guy that they, the guy that's the main character, Mervyn Johns, is like just suspicious of everything. As soon as he gets there, everything's deja vu. He knows where things are that most people wouldn't know if they just walked into somebody's house. He swears he's never been here, but then he tells everyone that he knows exactly who they are. He recognizes them all, and, you know, talks about this is a dream. He has a recurring nightmare that he has that all of these people are in the same place and they all tell stories. And it's a very interesting idea in the sense that having a character just show up and he's like, oh, I know who all you people are. How
the
could
beginning
you know
is
that?
So ambiguous. I had no idea which way it was going to end up going. Yeah. I didn't know if it was going to be a ghost story or these people were crazy and going to kidnap him. When he walked in that door, I had no idea which way this plot was going to go.
That's the way it almost feels like. The most obvious thing is that it would be something like that Twilight Zone episode, 5 people in search of an exit. Like they're all just trapped in this house and they can't get out, or they're ghosts that don't realize they've died or something like that. That seems to be like what your first natural assumption might be. Maybe the most obvious plot idea they could have. And then they all start, you have the one doubting character, the doctor, who doesn't believe in
the doubting doctor.
Yeah, the doubting doctor. He doesn't believe in the, in the, you know, the psychology of dreams, that they have any significance. It seems he pretty much, you know, always has an answer for why something had to have happened that way, and is always shooting everyone's ideas down. And, you know, everyone tries to prove that, you know, he's not crazy, that something about his dream is true, which he makes predictions that keep coming true. But he just can't seem to, he says he never remembers his dream a few seconds after waking up, but the longer he's there, the more and more he keeps like stumbling onto things that he remembers are going to happen, which are all like really weird things. He's like, there's a dark haired lady that's poor. And he's like, and I'm going to punch that girl in the face later or something like that. Mm-hmm. You're like, what is he talking about?
My favorite prediction is you're going to get punched in the face.
Yeah, when he tells that girl, that's one of the, there are a lot of good comedic moments when the girl's mother shows up and is like, oh, you have to go home. You're bothering all these poor people. And she's like, but Mr. Craig said he's going to punch me in the face. And she's like, well, I'm sure he can punch someone else in the face, sweetie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good, this falls into that tradition of, the same with like the Amicus ones. There is a lot of humor in it. It's not just all about ghost stories and, you know, trying to be frightening. There's a lot of humor, specifically like British type humor in this one. And especially some of these stories are very obviously, they were reused at some point in some Twilight Zone episodes. Like a few of these are 100% like, that's a Twilight Zone episode.
A lot of things do carry on to other horror films, and it might be indirect at this point because it's so old, but for example, one of the stories that deals with the ventriloquist dummy was really reminiscent to the first episode of Chucky that I watched last week. It had the exact same scene, essentially, where the person was doing ventriloquism and calling out the audience and making fun of them and mocking them. And it was an identical scene. And I don't even know if that was referenced or the writer thought, oh, Don Mancini, this is an original idea in my head and that it's never been done before.
Nah, well, I'm sure even if he didn't, that's the thing. It's passed so many times that even if he's never seen Dead of Night, it's popped up in other things. Again, there's the Goosebumps has the slappy character, which is, you know, killer ventriloquist doll comes to life. There's been that plot point is the one that's probably been, out of all of them, is probably the one that's been used more times than any other one. So it's like, yeah, again, you're to go back to like what the original reference is. Even if you haven't seen this, you've seen a version of it that's slowly made its way through the history of film and TV and books, that it's eventually gotten to you and you're like, oh, killer ventriloquist doll, even though it's been done like 80 years ago. Might think it's something new, but
yeah. And obviously that is this film's money shot, the doll, especially when I put in the Blu-ray and that's the background. They don't give a fuck about any of the other stories.
Yeah, it is the biggest story.
Ultimately, the imagery though for that is the scariest out of all of them.
It's the flat out like creepiest of all of them. But some of the other, I do enjoy all of the stories to some degree. The first story again is another one that you've seen like pop up all over the place. The you know, guy has a near death experience, and then while he's in the hospital, hears some sort of, it gets like deathly silent while he's just sitting there, and then he throws the curtains open and there's the phantom cab driver that's like, got room for one more inside. And then that predicts his death, or predicts that's like a very final destination. Even you can even point to something like that, like seeing your own death and
yeah,
figuring out how to avoid it.
My first thought when I saw it was that Coen Brothers film, I can't remember what it was called now. The Western that they did for Netflix a little.
No, Buster Scruggs.
Yeah, Buster Scruggs. The very last one is this black wagon that pulls up, and you can you essentially get the vibe that all the people in this wagon are dead. So when I saw that guy chilling outside the window, and clearly I don't know much of the period, but you could tell that that was definitely meant for a coffin.
Yeah, it's a hearse. Back in those days, which that there's another funny connection to a film we did last year. The character that plays the driver, and then he's later the bus driver, is the guy from Peeping Tom that goes into the shop and is like, I'm looking for some secret things.
Oh, really?
It's the same guy.
Well, that's some fun trivia.
Yeah, that was a random bit that they brought up, because they said like he was known to be like, he was in a lot of the movies for Ealing, which is the studio that made this film, that he was like always like the drunk character was like usually what he played.
Well, Peeping Tom was our last anniversary episode.
Yeah.
I had done the Halloween episode for Three Demers recently. Actually just came out this past Monday. And when we were talking about it, it really didn't seem that Peeping Tom was really on their radar. So beyond just listening to our episode, seek out Peeping Tom, because that's a great stepping stone for the slasher genre. And there's a lot of things in that film that are like the next step. And this is a little odd. There's a lot of time that's passed, but I definitely felt Final Destination, Child's Play. I don't know if there are any other ones that like right off the bat. The one where they were playing hide and seek felt more Twilight Zone-y. It wasn't executed the best, but I was okay with what they were trying to do.
Yeah, that's the shortest. At least I want to say it's probably the shortest. That and maybe the first one are the two shortest of all the stories. They do progressively kind of get longer and more elaborate as you go through. But yeah, the first story is very simple, but again, I think it is it's an effective story. And I know somebody, I watched the behind the scenes, or not behind the scenes, but like the commentary where people are discussing the film, the historians, and like somebody brought up that everyone thinks that that's like an urban legend. Like people have heard that, like, oh yeah, the guy, you know, saw like a hearse driver that predicted his death or something. And the guy's like, no, that was just a random story written by like an author 200 years ago or something like that, that came up with that idea. And somehow that's what it's turned into that most people think about. But I think that one's effective.
That's how urban legends work, though.
Well, yeah, they get them from somewhere. The Christmas one's, yeah, I don't know. I know that's one they like kind of brought up as the one that people like the least, mostly because it doesn't do anything that great. It's just kind of like an interesting kind of ghost story, you know, where the young girl is in a house with a bunch of other kids, and she finds a kid, and he's talking about how his sister hates him after one of the other boys told her about a girl that killed her brother in this very house. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those like, and this is where the murder took place kind of stories. Like, oh, it's haunted. there's another, they had a lot of good trivia that they brought up, that the story that's based off of, cause it is based off of a true story of a woman that killed her brother when she was a kid. And they said that, she died the year this film was made. They were like, she almost lived long enough to see this movie made about her from killing her brother like almost 100 years earlier or something like that.
That's wild trivia, though.
It feels
right off the bat to me when I watch this, it feels as if it could be made a couple decades after. Possibly in the 60s. It feels like that kind of caught up. That idea is really fresh. The individual stories are fun, and I think the overall story kind of connects nicely, and I really wasn't expecting that. For some reason, I was more so expecting they were just going to say, and those are the stories, and the end.
Yeah. You know? Or he's going to wake up and it is just a dream and nothing else happens.
Yeah.
But yeah, then we have the third story, which I do like. I do really like the third story, the mirror. There's something like really weird, like it's such like a basic idea that the guy sees some sort of like fantasy world in his mirror that his wife buys for him. Mm-hmm. And every time he looks in it, he just sees this. Yeah. The way they play it though is funny. Like he doesn't see things that you would think like would normally disturb people. He just sees this like really elaborate room with like a fancy fireplace and like it looks like a very well, you know, well kept house, and that freaks him out to no end. There it is.
Well, I think the idea that the thing that freaks him out more so than anything else has to be the fact that this guy is looking in a mirror and seeing himself in a place that is not his home. So right off the bat, I think that works just because it doesn't have to be a creepy place. It's not even really creepy. Like he doesn't look like he's in a haunted house. It just looks like he's in a like a very rich home. And I do kind of like where the concept of it goes somewhat of being linked to the previous owner. I think a lot of these stories, though, too, they would probably work almost if they could be their own movie or have more screen time for each story.
Yeah.
Because that was one that I think they could... I feel like the biggest flaw with the majority of the stories are that there's just some random exposition and it's done. You know, they go back and they tell that girl that the kid's been dead, strangled by her sister, and it's like, oh, I can't believe it. And this was similar, where they went back to the mirror shop, and they're like, oh, yeah, the history on that mirror. Wait till I tell you now after you already have it.
Yeah.
You think it would? They could have cut that out really easily where she didn't want to say why the mirror was so cheap or something, but she knew in advance. So it was kind of like a weird, I don't know. But I think for the most part, the shots and everything, they felt like they were very well constructed, all the scenes. They put a lot of time into it. It felt more cinematic than I was expecting from its time.
Yeah, I like that's one of the only ones that like I really enjoy. I really enjoy the music in that one. Every time he looks in the mirror and it's like this super... like over the top, like da 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 da. Like every time he looks in the mirror, it gets like the score gets like way over the top with like how much they're really trying to like make you feel like, no, you need to be scared of this first. You need to feel the fear that he's feeling. So they really heighten up the soundtrack when they play those moments.
Yeah. And what would you say is the worst one?
I don't even want to say it's the worst one. It definitely is a weird one. I'll say the reason I don't think it's bad. I think it fits perfectly because it's a good.
You're gonna say the same thing.
I know what you're probably thinking, but yeah, the golf one is great, and it's almost perfect because it's like a great like kind of tension breaker, because you had like these three stories that are like all like definitely more leaning towards all out trying to be scary, you know, the ghost kids and the husband that gets possessed by the mirror and the guy, you know, predicting his own death from a phantom hearse driver. And it's good that they set up before you get to the best story. They put in this random, like more or less comedy story. That's not scary at all. It doesn't have any, it's slightly morbid in that a character kills themselves in like one of the most, absurd ways possible of literally just walking into a lake until he drowns.
The logic in my brain said there's no way that you could drown yourself if you're not at least tying something to your leg that takes their willpower away from you once you're in the water.
Yeah.
Like you would float to the top. I think it'd be incredibly hard to just walk into the lake and just drown.
It would at least have been more believable. He only carries like one club. Like if he would have carried like his whole like golf bag in with him or something that was like weighted down, that he was carrying that over his shoulder. But,
and then the weird thing is they're playing this round of golf for this woman's hand, which I don't even think she's involved in this for some reason.
And she thinks it's a great idea.
And I like how much time passes, a year, maybe some time passes, and the guy gives, he goes golfing at, you know, the same place and golfs next to that lake, totally unfazed by the fact that this guy killed himself there. Like, that would really bother me if you killed yourself in a lake. I don't think I could go back to that lake. Yeah. Even if you did it in a funny way.
Like, how do they play golf for the girl's hand in marriage, and then what is the one guy, the guy that wins shows back up and he's like, "Hey, I won. We're getting married. Where's your buddy?" I mean, he killed himself because I cheated, but you know, that's not the point. And it's a fun one too, since it has the only other thing I always know those guys from is Lady Vanishes, because they're both in that film together. They basically always play. And that's the, I'm
it's
assuming
been a while since I watched. So, a lot of people seemed familiar and I wasn't picking up on exactly what they were from, but assuming that it was the 40s and it had to be something from that era, 'cause they look the same.
Yeah.
From the UK. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Especially how many times I've watched Lady Vanishes and older Hitchcock films.
I assume those guys just are probably more well known in the UK as like some sort of comedy team or something, because they basically just play their same characters. They're almost identical in The Lady Vanishes, is just two guys that like to talk about playing golf and like just traveling around together or something like that. Like, they're just two weird guys that are just like that. It's like, I don't know. It's 1936 in the UK. And it's like, what do those guys do? They're just two guys. They play golf and travel with each other. They're not in a relationship. They're just really best friends. They smoke pipes together and hang out.
James posted something on Facebook not too long ago about golf. Did you see that?
I don't think so.
It was something along the lines of the sport of golf was invented so two guys don't have to ask each other to go for a walk.
I did see that. That is 100% like that's the impression you get with these two guys, is it's just like they're just two really good friends. They just like hanging out, and you know, they had to have a reason to hang out, so they picked golf. But yeah, that is a funny story. Like I said, I think it works in the context of the movie. On its own, it's like not, it wouldn't work that well, but I think the way they place it is kind of, like I said, like more of a, like kind of a break from the scares that you've got going on in the other stories that are trying to frighten you, to just get one that's just flat out not trying to scare you at all. It's just trying to like be goofy and ridiculous on its own terms. And the ending makes me laugh a lot too. I like that the character tries to haunt his best friend and then can't remember how to get himself back out of it. So he's like, "I've got to be within 6 feet of you at all times." And on the night of his wedding, he like the other character tries to sneak off to his bedroom with his wife. And then he just magically disappears into the bedroom. And he's like, "I can't believe you do something like that." He's like, "I told you, man, 6 feet. I got to be 6 feet at all times."
I think the humor was weird for most of the stuff. So you're right, this was actually a really good segment before we got into a darker segment, because everything was kind of dark up to that point. You are right about that.
Yeah, everything's dark. You get that little fun moment right before it sets you up for the ventriloquist dummy, which like you said, is the one that is the most well known and probably the one that's been redone the most often in hundreds of different versions of the ventriloquist doll that has a life of its own. Although this one's pretty good in the fact that you don't ever really know that the doll is alive. They definitely play to the idea that there's enough moments where it seems like, oh yeah, that doll is 100% alive. But then there is enough that like they don't show you that it could just be that guy's out of his mind and just is like almost like Norman Bates level of just, he thinks he's half of his brain is the dummy and he like projects himself into it. 'Cause we never see the doll actually like move on its own. He is always having to like carry it around with him. It's like, we never see the doll actually be animated and move by itself. We never witness that, but the doll obviously gets into places that it shouldn't possibly be able to get into. So I do enjoy that they don't flat out show the doll move, other than in the dream nightmare sequence, which is completely separate.
Well, you are right, though, for the psychological aspect of it, which kind of makes it really cool, is that it moves around for the one character and it could totally be in the one character's head. So imagine if you had, sorry, Child's Play. It's the best known one. But Chucky only ever messed with, or like, it could totally be a reveal at the end that Andy really was killing these people and blaming it on his doll.
Because yeah, that could have been a good stuff plot. Was yeah.
inside of his head the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the only one that witnesses it moving until the end when we're, when, you know, everyone else finally sees it attacking them and stuff like that.
Right, or you go the route of Child's Play where people think he's killing everybody and he's like has to convince them it's the doll.
Yeah.
Do something, Chucky. Show them, Chucky. Well, they didn't really have batteries, I'm assuming, back then. So they couldn't have flipped over this dummy and been like, oh shit, he has no batteries.
Yeah, he's just all wood.
There's no hand in him right now.
But yeah.
He's the imagery, though, for him is so creepy that he doesn't have to be being used. Like, he's creepy when they get in that fight at the bar there. And he's kind of half leaned over the bar.
It's, yeah. Like, he almost falls off the stool. I do like, right. Yeah, I don't know.
And something that's a good shot, too. That makes me think of, like, a real modern action shot where the camera pans away to get, like, this nice shot of all these chairs getting knocked down. And usually you don't have that in the 40s. The 40s is pretty stationary. The cameras are big. Yeah. And they don't try to do a lot of different shots.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Something about the dummy insulting everyone does make me laugh, too, especially with, like, the two women that go in there and he's like drunk, so he's just like sitting there, which again makes you think like how could he be doing all this ventriloquism stuff when he's like completely hammered? But you know, when the girl goes over and the dummy's like, beat it hooch or whatever he says to her, and she's like, did you hear that he called me? It's like, you gotta apologize to the lady. And the dummy's like, I don't see no ladies here.
Yeah. And I do love when he keeps interrupting, even after they're done with their performance.
Yeah.
And they start doing the singing number again, and he, like, starts speaking, and he's, like, pushed back through, and he's talking to them.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Meet me in the back. Like, Sylvester,
you gotta meet me in my dressing room. Which, again, is like, yeah, that's almost where it's kind of like one of those.
Do dummies sound like that from this movie? Because dummies have that sound in almost
That's how they're
movies.
Always portrayed. I have a feeling. I mean, yeah, because I don't know of any other movie that would have featured, like, ventriloquist dummies like this prior
Possibly
to this.
That's the
I've,
way that they have to that do I've ever it. Seen. That's the way they can speak.
I think so. I mean, they do always. If you watch, like, a lot of people that do ventriloquism, like, their characters always do have, like,
none of that.
just watching it all the time. I mean, that Jeff Dunham, he's hilarious.
He has it a little bit, but he does have different accents and stuff for his
characters. Well, he's probably better than they were in the 40s. He's mastered the craft a lot more than they could back 80 years ago.
And he's stand-up on top of that.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I guess you'd have to be funny, or who really wants to watch somebody that can, like, they're talented enough to throw their voice, but they're not talented enough to make it interesting.
Yeah, it's a useless talent if it's not doesn't have any material.
Also, you got to be pretty thrilled with the magic of filmmaking that you don't actually have to be able to do that. Like, it would be so easy to just have somebody off screen talking.
Yeah,
I do like that. Like, let's see, I want to see this guy's act. I want to see what he's like. He's the most legendary, or he's an up-and-coming ventriloquist that everyone's talking about. And
I got to see him.
Jeff Dunham, you brought up, but I can't think of anyone else in my mind that I could name a person that does this.
Yeah, it's not a hot commodity. We did get some ventriloquism in Halloween Kills. There was a ventriloquist at the talent show in that film.
When we talk about it, but we won't talk about that because we've already recorded it.
We're not
and
on
we
this
don't
episode,
talk about
no.
it.
But yeah, I don't know. Something dolls. I wouldn't say dolls freak me out. It is kind of more or less like, I don't know. There's something weird about ventriloquist dummies. Maybe it's just like, it's the look of them. Like something about like Child's Play doesn't freak me out or something like that. It almost borderlines with like things that have like mannequins in them. That always weirds me out. Like, Somebody was playing a game. I had to look up and see what the title was, but they were playing a video game, and I was watching them play through it, and they got into a house, and there's like mannequins everywhere, and they immediately start freaking out, and he's like, I don't like the mannequins, man. He's like, what are they doing? And every time he walks into one room, and it's like there's a mannequin with like the sink running, and he's like, okay, I guess there's a mannequin there. And he turns around and there's one like in the doorway, and he's like, oh god. And then you just hear the sink stop, and he's like, I think the other one's right behind us.
Resident Evil 7 did it, and actually,
yeah,
one of the Spider-Mans did it. I remember there's a little part in a mission where you walk past these mannequins and you do your thing. When you turn around, they're in different places. But it never, it's not a part, it's not a plot point for the game.
It's just a random, it's just like a random setting. It never goes
answered. Yeah, just to make you, just to be creepy.
I feel like it was just built by the developers just to be a weird thing, just to freak you out.
Mannequins, the game.
Yeah.
That's in, you're going to be horny or you're going to be freaked out.
That's in, a game I used to play, Condemned. That was like an old Xbox 360 game, and they had a whole level that was, you're in like an abandoned shopping mall, and it's nothing but mannequins. And then like the mannequins don't come to life, but the killers that are after you like blend in with the mannequins. So you'll just like walk around a corner and be like, oh cool, 20 mannequins. And then one will just like jump out from the middle.
And mannequins, they were in Halloween, 2018.
That's right. We're bringing it all back to Halloween.
Well, we have to, because Halloween's coming up. We're essentially building up to Halloween.
It's true.
Without any Halloween movies, because we've already discussed them all on our podcast.
Yeah.
Go back and listen to them. Something. Maybe I'll bring them back just so they're at the top of the chain. People will be like, holy just bringing shit, it back. Your very first episode sucked.
Yeah, there'll be a very big difference between that first one. But yeah, I don't know. There is something about that last story. And again, I bring up that same comparison that it is almost like very much a Norman Bates type story with a character just losing his mind, and the doctor even almost gives basically the same type of narration. And I have to think that Hitchcock probably saw this movie. This is when he was still, I guess he would have probably he would have been in Hollywood, I guess, at this point in his career. I think he was done with all of his British movies, but I almost feel like he had to have watched this movie at some point, probably. And like the doctor's given his
American movie,
maybe Spellbound.
It wasn't Shadow of a Doubt.
No, it wasn't Shadow of a Doubt. Oh, you know what? Might be Rebecca. Cause I'm pretty sure Spellbound was for,
well, there you go. Rebecca definitely was American made. Yeah. And that was 1940. That was a very, exactly.
That was a very early one. Yeah. So I think that I want to say that's his first one. Figure this out.
We're basically cinematic detectives.
Yeah.
Put us on the case and we're going to figure it out.
We're hot on the case. We're always ready.
All our problems are caused by ourselves. It's questions nobody asked, but we got confused on. So we had to do the detective work to figure it out.
It's what we're always here for. Yeah, Rebecca. Because his last British movie was Jamaica Inn, which is terrible. But Rebecca was his first Hollywood film, which 1940. But yeah, I still feel like he probably saw this somewhere, or maybe just maybe even Robert Block, when he was coming up with Psycho, maybe saw this movie. Cause like I said, the diagnosis that the doctor gives for the ventriloquist character is like almost identical to the diagnosis the doctor gives at the end of Psycho. And that like, he brings up, oh, his brain is in two. He thinks he's himself sometimes. And sometimes he thinks he's the dummy. And they came crashing together tonight. It's almost the exact same, narration at the end of that story, which then leads into our main character's nightmare following that tale, which that's another one of his interesting predictions that they think they disprove, because he says that the guy that owns the house that invited him out is going to mention somebody dying that he doesn't know, which he's friends with the golfers. And they're like, oh, there you go. He told you about that guy's death. You didn't know that guy. And then later he like He says something about like George died, and he's like, oh, he said George died, and they're like, oh, that's what they call the power grid or something like that, or that's what they call like the power company is George or something like that in the UK.
Makes sense.
Yeah, just that weird British ideas they've got there. Yeah,
there's never been a more British thing, confusing thing to me than when we watched what was that made for TV thing? I can't. What's the title of that stupid movie? Anyways, they kept talking about the glory hole, and I'm like, I don't think that means the same thing at all.
I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I remember something about made for TV British thing. I remember us having that conversation, but I can't remember what the movie is at all. You're gonna search British glory holes and just get like all sorts of
no, results. I can't do that.
But yeah, he
Ghost Watch.
Oh, Ghost Watch. That. Oh yeah.
In Ghost Watch, I remember that now. They're like, I saw the ghost in the glory hole, and I'm like, where? What does that?
Yeah, we mean? Were trying to figure out. I think we had to ask Alex what that meant, because she was from the UK.
And she didn't know.
She was like, I don't even know what that means, or something like that.
I don't even know what it means in English.
Yeah.
Like, well,
Now I remember that. Yeah, when the guy's like, I think he's like interviewing the people outside the house, and that's what they tell him. And he's like, but he doesn't like think that it's a weird thing. And I'm just like, that means something completely different in America, I guess. I do remember that
seeing
now.
Keep seeing the ghost in the glory hole. Yeah. We saw it in the glory hole, and I'm like, I know it doesn't mean the same thing, or it wouldn't be on fucking television.
Yeah, they wouldn't be just saying it over and over again on TV. But yeah, I do remember that now. Oh god,
their humor is a lot drier usually.
Yeah,
their horror though, I mean, I don't think it's all there yet, or at least at this time. But it gets pretty good, I think, with the Hammer films. They get pretty good.
Yeah. With the,
I actually thought the one guy was the Hammer guy or something, because his name's like Hamir. Did you see that? One of the four directors is a Hamir, and at first I thought it was a Hammer, and I'm like, oh my god, is this the origin of the Hammer?
No, we're still too early for that. Yeah, I think Hammer gets it, and like I said, I really enjoy all of the Amicus anthology films. They're pretty much, at this point, they're the ones that are the most known for doing anthology films. That was pretty much their entire idea. That they made like 8 or 9 just of those. Mm-hmm. And those are all really good, especially I think my favorites are probably the Tales from the Crypt and Vault of Horrors ones that they do, that they really get into some really interesting stuff with those in terms of what you can do with short stories. Cause that's where I feel like this movie is good and I do enjoy it, but I think they still just don't know how to like maximize to get as much as you can out of like a 20-minute story. Like you really have to work, and you almost need like you were saying earlier, like how a lot of these just end with some like weird exposition. They don't end with like a big like finale, and I think the Amicus ones they like kind of like really perfected that like final like great shock sequence to like really leave you with like some sort of really strong impression, that as soon as you saw that you're like oh god, that's like, that was crazy, or that was terrifying, or something like that. Whereas these ones just kind of end with characters like explaining it to you, like how, like why it's scary. Like, this is why you should be scared of it. Which I think there's actually, they reuse the story. There is a character that has a mirror that he gets from like an antique shop in one of the Amicus films. It's one where I can't think of which one it is, but Peter Cushing's like an antique store dealer or something like that, and he sells someone a mirror, and it's kind of like the same thing. Like, the guy sees like weird things coming out of the mirror when he stands in front of it, and it like it makes him want to kill people. Hmm. But being in the 70s, he actually does start killing people. It's not just implied that he wants to kill people. He actually does start doing it.
Yeah, that story I think has the most potential, that not enough comes out of it.
Yeah.
It would actually be really cool if the guy was able to have time to figure out what happened by what he was seeing in the mirror, like piecing it together by things he was able to see. I don't know if, you know, like taking the mirror to different parts of the house and being able to see different things from a different time. Something like that, instead of the really generic, the wife was like, oh my God, this story that I knew nothing about. Just a little bit of work and it would have been, could have been probably creepier by itself.
Yeah.
It could have been its own movie.
Yeah, there's like more stuff you could put in there or something, like, or that he starts seeing more, like you're saying, like more than just the room. He starts seeing like if he looked in the mirror and actually saw his wife with like another guy in the mirror, and like that's his jealousy, which he doesn't sound like he sees anything. He just starts thinking about stuff like that. But if they like actually showed like, you know, something going on in the background that he's like, oh, is that my wife? Like with a guy, like going into the bedroom or something like that. Like something like that would have been pretty interesting.
Right. They bring up that guy like out of nowhere. I know you're seeing our friend. And she's like, we made fun of him. And he's like, I know.
Yeah. So yeah, that is the one that I think
I remember horror
that I think would work really well as like a bigger story. But I do think the creepiest part.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say I have to say the creepiest part of this film is that final nightmare sequence. Once that whole thing starts, it starts getting like way off the rails in a way that the rest of the movie has not gone at all.
And I don't know, it's a lot of fun. It's the best part of the whole movie.
The last part is fun. He starts doing all the things that he said he was going to do. He punches that girl in the face when she's it's entertaining to see him like move through everyone's memories. He sees the kids at the party. He like punches that girl to get her to stop screaming because everyone's looking for him. He gets to the mirror and he's like, you gotta hide me in the mirror, man. You gotta let me go in the room. I gotta get in the mirror. You know, he runs into the cab driver. I think the only thing that they don't work in there is the golf story at all. That's never connected in there in his final dream. But when he's in there with the doll, the ventriloquist doll at first it's like creepy. It's like, oh, he's in there with that doll by itself. But then when it's 100% just an actual person wearing like a giant doll mask. And I'm just like, and he just slowly starts creeping towards him. I'm just like, I don't know. This is starting to get really weird now.
Yeah. That's when it starts getting the weirdest for definitely. There are some things in there too, that I think would be creepy after the fact, like when they were playing hide and seek with all the kids, just to think, oh, all those kids are probably dead now.
Yeah.
That would be a really creepy place to visit. They were creepier than the kid that was actually killed, I thought. They were dressed all weird. I was like,
It's a weird costume party.
But yeah, I guess overall, I think the mirror probably had the most potential for me. The golf one, maybe my least favorite. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was funny, but it just felt like so many things in my mind, I kept getting like, whoa. It was less funny to me than it should have been, I think. But out of all the stories, I like the dummy one. I could have watched it just been in the nightclub the whole time. Like, they could have, if they just did a single set, that would have been really cool, I think. It's all the potential. It's the potential. Yeah. So it's exactly what you're saying, Chuck. It's the beginning
the first one,
of
yeah.
something.
Yeah, it's the start of it. Again, like I said, I think they've taken these ideas much further later on. You know, there's something about a short story that's always really good. Like, you know, you can pack a lot of things into a full length novel. And I feel like that's the thing. Like, doing short stories is almost harder because you have to be like very economical with what you do. Otherwise it just turns into a lot of rambling and too much. And I think that's
I mean, in filmmaking, essentially you want to be able to make a short film before you can make a feature length film.
Yeah.
If you can't tell a story in 10 minutes, how are you going to tell a story in an hour?
Yeah. That's almost, and some of it, sometimes it's just like you either have too little time or too much time. Because that's one of the things I've brought up.
Sounds like a fortune cookie.
Yeah. Sometimes you have too much. Sometimes you don't have enough. We watched the Twilight Zone before, and I always think the best episodes are just their standard, like, 20-minute episodes. Some of the worst episodes are when they did the fourth season and they expanded it to an hour.
Almost all of them. Yeah. Almost every single hour-long episode. They're not as interesting
because you figure out the twist by the halfway point where you would normally end the episode with the twist in the regular episode. So it's, like I said, it's a tough act to do a short story and make it be effective, but you had to keep it at, like, you know, 15, 20 minutes. Otherwise, then people start, you know, you figure out what the plot is going to be, you figure out what the twist is, and then you're just sitting there for another 20 minutes like, yeah, get to it. I know what it's going to be like. I figured it out. You don't have to keep going on. So
I just like, yeah, get to it.
Yeah. That's what we're all saying when we watch movies. That's what I said. That's what I said during Halloween Kills. I said, yeah, just get to it already. Just get the Michael killing.
Well, you got to that pretty quickly.
Yeah, we got to that.
No time to die. Yeah. Just get to the espionage shit, please.
Yeah.
But I think we need to do a theme that is just all slow burn movies.
Yeah.
We're just like, I just don't understand why I just didn't get to
just,
it.
Just get to it, man. just get it over with.
Did it really need all that time just to get to it?
Did they have to do that?
Yeah, I think that was fun. This was Kino Lorbo. Lorber? Jesus Christ. Kino Lorber. I don't know when the Blu-ray came out, but I got it from Walmart for $10. And to get free shipping, I ended up buying a Batman comic, so went a little crazy.
There you go.
Well, you know how I go. I was like, I'm not paying for shipping. I'm going to buy more shit so the shipping's free.
And then the next film we're getting to is also a Kino film.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. You're right. I'll save it for the next film. I didn't give it as much thought as how you're thinking. Oh, well, I'll go with the first. I'll take it back to the beginning. My mind was more so, I haven't watched this in forever. I don't really remember much about it. Yeah. So it could be awful. The one that I remember the most isn't even the main one that you see, like, advertised. But it is actually really funny if you think about the advertising for Dead of Night and the one I picked. The main imagery that they use is very similar. Like, the things, like, the main, that story is very, very similar to each other.
Yeah.
Is that a good way to tease? I mean, I don't want to straight out say it.
I think it's a good enough way. Yeah, it's something about the killer inanimate objects, something like that. Yeah, I think this was a good. We're getting a good chunk of stories in here. We could have gone. Realistically, I didn't even think about it. We could have gone crazy and gotten like deeper into something like do the ABCs of horror. Then we could pack 26 stories into one episode if we really want to get wild. But that's again to bring up, that's almost a case of those episodes are all too short to be interesting at all. And that one's those films are like a good case of, like, I don't know, you might have taken it a bit too far with the anthology idea. You might have really shot yourself in the foot, because that's kind of what the draw of these type of films is like, oh, this story isn't good. It's going to be over in like 5 minutes. Like, you'll move to the next story and maybe that one will be better. But when you have a film where you have to do that with 26 stories and maybe only like five of them are good out of the entire film, that's a lot of downtime to be sitting there.
Maybe a weird way to construct it, because if we are talking about it on the podcast and each thing's 5 minutes long, to break it down, I mean, sometimes we're not even that interesting when we talk about a 2-hour movie.
Yeah. There were definitely, if we were to ever cover those films, it would 100% be like, okay, we're going A through Z. We'd get to like a letter and just be like, I don't even want to talk about that one. It wasn't worth talking about.
There are a lot of things that I'd like to discuss on the podcast, but it just doesn't really work out time wise and it would just overtake the podcast.
Yeah.
We talked about Bond. To do all the Bonds would be almost an entire year. You know, well, a half a year to cover them. And if we did something like a show, I'd always like to talk about Twilight Zone for us to do all the Twilight Zones and not become a Twilight Zone podcast, just to do a bonus episode once a week that's Twilight Zone, would fucking kill us to do.
Yeah.
That would be insanely hard.
You really have to, like, edit it down. It's insanely hard to do
one thing a week. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, if we got on and talked about it for, you know, 20 minutes. But then here's another thing. We're doing it, and we're not really putting that much time into it, so how good is it could it possibly be?
Yeah.
We don't have to do all of them. We could curate it. We could do a Twilight Zone night, kind of like how they show at New Year's Eve. We just talk about, like, four of them.
It's always a good time.
That might actually be worth doing something like that, Chuck. See, we're coming up with ideas as in real time.
It's the best way to get to figure stuff out for us.
Well, thank you for finding that. I don't think I would have watched it. I never really heard of it. I don't think I heard about this Dead of Night at all.
That's how I don't know. That's how I always, I guess that's just like a personality thing. I don't know. Just how my brain works. And I've talked to like another guy that I work with that he says he's the same way of like, it's the same as like when you hear a maybe a new band or something like that. And I'm like, I'm going to go back and listen to like the first album. I don't care if it's garbage. I'm going to go back and listen to it. Cause I want to hear like what they started with. And that's how my brain works with like, when I look up, you know, try to see like movies that I maybe don't know about. That's how I found, Hell's a Poppin', was I wanted to know more information about, Gremlins and Gremlins 2. So I was like researching things. And that's when I came across like the quote from like Joe Dante. It's like, oh yeah, it's one of my favorite movies. I stole like all of my great gags from that film because it's got like the best jokes in the world. And again, no, almost nobody has heard of that movie nowadays because it's like completely forgotten. But it's a great movie.
It is. I think my brain kind of works in a similar way where I want to start at the beginning too, but your mind to pick out anthology horror and go that route. I mean, I would probably do something similar. I kind of do with any time that Scorsese does it a lot. He'll bring up some random movie. He's like, oh yeah, this one movie from 1962 and you never heard of it.
Yeah.
And you watched it and like that's the only way that you hear about it is because he talked about it. So to be like, oh, I don't know why you're doing research for Gremlins, but looking in the Gremlins and getting that quote from Joe Dante and that makes sense to me. That's the way that I would want to work because some of these movies, I don't really need much more than a recommendation. I kind of prefer not even to know the plot if I can get away without finding it out.
Yeah.
So you recommend something and I love it when it's a boring title. So I have no idea what it's like. This movie is called The Lamp from 1942. And you think I would never pick up The Lamp. Nothing about that sounds interesting. And you watch it, and the whole movie, you're just like, oh, holy shit. Oh, holy shit. I can't believe this. What? This is 1942? Oh, fuck. And then for the rest of your life, you're like, there's this great movie called The Lamp. You should check it out.
That's how, I don't know. That's what I'm always looking for is always trying to find something new. I feel like...
old.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Something that I haven't heard of before. And I feel like... That's the problem of being someone I like need to find like a Quentin Tarantino thing. I could just be like, man, tell me about a movie I've never heard of. Cause like, you know, he's like just full of like, oh, no one's seen and his are like all super weird stuff. Like you've never seen The Golden Hammer. What's that? Oh, it's this Korean film from 1932 about zombies that fly around or something like that. It's like, yeah, I've never heard of that. Tell me more. Tell me where I can find that. That's where like
what always makes it interesting too. I was talking to Joel Cohen and I said you ripped it off from The Golden Hammer 1932. I don't know what that is, and I forced him to watch it and he totally admitted it.
Yeah. So that's what you need, someone that's like an encyclopedia of just random movies that you've never heard of from some other time. But then it's like yeah, Tarantino told me about this movie, but I can't find it anywhere. Yeah, it's because he's got the only print around.
Well, Chuck, you're living in a good time. For the most part, you can find things on the internet.
Yeah.
It's almost not impossible to search any random hard-to-find thing and be able to watch it somewhere. But to grow up back then, to grow up in the 90s, let alone the 60s or the 30s, word of mouth, and like, you're going to see this movie if you're in the 30s. You're going to see this movie, it's going to come to theaters, and you're going to have to remember it for the rest of your life because you're never going to fucking see it again.
So, yeah, I could see that being, like, one of those things, like, did you see that Dracula movie? No, I missed it, and then just be like, guess I'll just never see it then.
Well, also back then, you pay for a ticket, and it'll last you the whole day, so you could literally sit there and watch the movie 4 times, so... Probably why people can memorize these things a lot better.
Yeah, there's...
How was Dead at Night? Well, I watched it 5 times in the theater. Oh, 5 different days? No, it was just 1 day, 5 times.
Yeah, just sat there all day long, didn't feel like going anywhere else.
I didn't have friends or family at the time. I had Dead at Night.
That's all you needed.
We'll be back next week with my pick. It's not really a secret, but... I'm going to make it. Keep it a secret for some reason.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks.
We are Cinema D'Amore. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date with news and information on upcoming episodes. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, Pandora, Alexa, or iHeartRadio. It would be greatly appreciated if you subscribe to our podcast on your platform of choice. We also appreciate feedback, so rate us, review us, and let us know what you think. And above all else, thank you for listening.